Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library and the Members' Room for our last event of the month of April. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and I'm so glad the weather cooperated. We've been having events all this winter, and we've had a few evenings where we haven't had everyone show up because of the weather, but we couldn't have asked for a nicer day for Dr. Schneider's event tonight. Before I introduce our speaker, please let me ask if any of you have cell phones or laptops or anything that will make any kind of noise, if you could take it out and just silence it for the next hour. I think everyone would appreciate that. The Society Library relies on our members for support above and beyond the membership fees that we receive and the draw from our endowment. We do have a spring fundraising appeal that we've just started, and it takes care of such things as keeping this beautiful members' room in good shape. It takes care of buying books. It takes care of our events, our wonderful children's library, and our writers' room on the fifth floor. So if you're a library member, please consider helping us out this spring. And for those of you who have given already this year, thank you very much. We're really honored tonight to have Dr. Laura Schneider with us. Laura is a library member here at the Society Library, and her new book is Eye of the Beholder, Johannes Vermeer, Antoni von Leeuwenhoek, and the Reinvention of Seeing. She's also the author of another book. She lectured here a few years back on the Philosophical Breakfast Club that was published in 2011, and that won the Scientific American Notable Book and was also the 2011 Royal Institution of Australia poll for favorite science book, and an official selection of the TED Book Club. And I believe there's a great TED Talks recording of Dr. Schneider online that you can watch. She is a professor at St. John's University and very busy there. She also writes for the Wall Street Journal about science and ideas. Her new book, Eye of the Beholder, has already received a number of glowing reviews in New Scientist, in Nature, the Wall Street Journal, and the Daily Mail UK. And finally, there will be a question and answer period after her talk, and there are books available for sale outside with our friends from the corner bookstore. So please join me in a warm welcome to Dr. Laura Schneider.
Thank you. In the 1600s, something remarkable was happening in the Dutch Republic. Artists and scientists were using mirrors, lenses, and other optical instruments to look at the world in a different way. For the first time, it was realized that there was more than meets the eye, that there was a whole invisible world that we couldn't see without the use of these instruments. And in a small town in Holland called Delft, two men who were born the same week, who lived and worked their whole adult lives in close proximity, were using these optical instruments to change the way we see. The two geniuses of Delft, as they're known, of course, Johannes Vermeer, this is his painting, The Procurus. It's thought that this dapper young man over here is a self-portrait. If so, it's the only known portrait of Vermeer that we have. Antoni von Leeuwenhoek was painted later in his life when he was already famous. He's right over there. The two of them were born and baptized within 4 days of each other. This is the baptism registry of the Neue Kirk, the new church, where they were both baptized. On October 31st, Vermeer was baptized. On November 4th, Leeuwenhoek was baptized. They spent their whole adult lives living and working around the Delft Market Square, which was the area of an American football field without the end zones. It's quite small. Oops, I'm sorry. This is the Neue Kirk, where they were both baptized. This is the town hall where Leeuwenhoek would eventually have a civic appointment for 50 years or so. This is where Vermeer's father owned an inn and tavern on the Market Square when Vermeer was a boy. This is where Vermeer would eventually live when he married and lived with his mother-in-law. This is where the Artists Guild was, the street right behind the Market Square. And this is where Leeuwenhoek would live when he was married as an adult. So they lived and worked very closely together. Did they know each other? surely they knew each other as passing acquaintances. Even in New York City, you see the same people on the block, around the corner, going to the same dry cleaner. So they definitely recognized each other. Whether they were closer than that, we don't know for sure. But there's a web of connections that draws them together. They both lived their whole adult lives in a town of 20,000. Vermeer was the son of a cloth salesman who then later became an innkeeper. Leeuwenhoek started out as a cloth salesman before he got his position in the city government. Leeuwenhoek's mother married a second husband after Leeuwenhoek's father died. The second husband was a painter who had two sons from a prior marriage, who was also the member of the members of the Artists Guild the same time as Vermeer. And when Vermeer died at a young age, deeply in debt, with his finances in disarray, Leeuwenhoek was appointed as the executor of Vermeer's estate, which I think is evidence of some strength that they knew each other. But the most important connection between them is how they were both using lenses to look at the world in a way that no one else had ever done before. Just a quick primer course. There are two different kinds of lenses, two different basic kinds. The convex lens is narrower at the ends and wider in the middle. This is the shape of a lentil, which is where the word lens comes from. These lenses are easier to grind, so they were the ones that were first made. A concave lens is wider at the middle and narrower, wider at the ends and narrower in the middle. Those are harder to grind, so it took a little longer before people were able to make those. We know that convex lenses, the lentil-shaped ones, were being made for a long time. Here is one that traces back to antiquity. It was discovered in the 19th century, and the natural philosophers at the time tried to figure out what it could have been used for, an early telescope. Nobody knows, but it was ground into the shape of a lentil. Later on, by the 13th century, two convex lenses were being placed into frames and used as spectacles for reading glasses. And we have this wonderful painting from Tommaso di Modena from 1352, where we see a monk being the type of person who would most likely wear glasses for reading while illuminating manuscripts. Only later were glasses made for distance vision correction, because those require the concave lenses. But by the 17th century, spectacles of both kinds were being sold door to door by salesmen, as in this wonderful picture by Rembrandt, The Spectacle Seller, where we see a box full of spectacles being taken around the market square for people who look quite blind to try to pick out ones that would help them to see. So spectacles were around all over by the 17th century. Even earlier, people were using magnifying glasses. These are convex lenses. This is one from about 1500. By the late 1500s, artists were using magnifying lenses to make their paintings. These wonderful drawings of dragonflies here, they're just one of a series of hundreds and hundreds of studies made by Hofnagel at the end of the 1500s. And although he was an artist and he was drawing and painting these insects and small animals for artistic purposes, they're considered today among the first scientific studies of insects because of the detail that he was able to get using a magnifying glass. Later, we get these wonderful Dutch flower paintings that we all know and love. These were also painted often with magnifying glasses. Rachel Rausch was the daughter of the head of the botanical garden in Amsterdam, and he would bring home specimens that she could examine with a magnifying glass and paint in such beautiful configurations. We also get a combination of the insects and flowers in many of these flower paintings, where we see not only the blossoms being studied so carefully with all the striations on the leaf, on the petals, but the little creatures crawling around in creepy detail, but almost scientifically accurate detail. So artists were the first ones using magnifying glasses to study the natural world. It took a little longer for telescopes to be made. We don't know who was the first one to put two lenses in a tube and use it as a telescope. You would need a convex and a concave lens to do that, so it was at least when concave lenses were being made. By the early 1600s, three men from the Dutch Republic filed a patent application with the States General, which was the government of the Dutch Republic, at just about the same time. The States General wisely decided not to grant anyone a patent because clearly if three people had the idea at the same time, it was not innovative. Galileo made this one about the same time. As soon as Galileo had his telescope, he turned it to the heavens and examined the moon, and this is what he saw. Now, Galileo was not the first one to use a telescope to look at the moon. Some Englishmen had done it first. But what Galileo saw was that the splotches on the moon, which he drew, these are drawings he made himself, and he drew so beautifully, were not just somehow clouds in front of the moon or otherwise problems with the optics of the telescope, but he recognized these as shadows cast by mountains and craters on the moon. This was revolutionary because the prior view to the Copernican view of the universe held that the moon, like all the other bodies going around the sun, going around the earth, were made of a shining, smooth, perfect substance called the ether. So there could be no mountains or craters on the moon, according to the old Ptolemaic theory of the universe. Others had seen them before Galileo, but he recognized them for craters and mountains. And the reason he could do that was because Galileo was trained as an artist. So he recognized what he saw through the telescope as similar to what he would draw as an artist to depict shadows on a planar substance. So it was his training in perspective theory that allowed him to see these blotches over the moon's surface as shadows cast by mountains and craters. One of the Englishmen who had seen these blotches earlier had thought it looked a lot like his cook's treacle tart. So he did not see it as geographically interesting. Now, it took a little longer for microscopes. It probably is the case that Galileo took his telescope, turned it the other way, looked through the far lens, putting that one next to his eye, and used it to view insects close up. Soon, he basically put it standing up in an upright position like this and created something very similar to the double lens type of microscopes we all know today. It was a Dutch man, Cornelis Drebbel, living in England at the time, who invented a better method for making microscopes. Because instead of using the convex-concave array that Galileo had used, because that's what he used in his telescope, Drebbel used two convex lenses, and that allowed for a larger field of vision with a shorter tube. As soon as the microscope was around, everybody started using them to examine insects, very much like the artists had done with their magnifying glasses. And there was something fascinating to these students of nature about the eyes of insects. They all were studying the eyes. Here we have these details of the eye of the bee in this first published microscopic study that came out in 1613. Later, in 1614, Giambattista Odierna published his Eye of the Fly, again in great detail. And finally, in 1665, we get this magisterial drawing by Robert Hooke of the eye of a drone fly. And it was like the early microscopists wanted to use these optical instruments to understand natural optical instruments, our own eyes, or the eyes of a fly, because of the way they were concentrating on the insect's eyes. Now, it wasn't only artists and the natural scientists who were looking through lenses at the time. Everyday people were carrying around magnifying glasses in their pockets. They called them flea glasses because they would take them out and examine their cheese. And they realized that the dust on the rind of their howdah was not dust, but little cheese mites moving around. And instead of making them never eat cheese again, as it would have done for me, they were fascinated by this. And they would look at their bread and see, you know, mold growing in their bread and little flies in their bread. So everybody was fascinated by the idea of seeing what wasn't visible without a lens. So it's not that surprising that Leeuwenhoek became interested in lenses. Earlier, when he was working as a cloth salesman and when he apprenticed with one in Amsterdam, he would have used a magnifying lens like this, which is a little bit later. This is from an 18th century mill. But the people who worked there would carry them around because by looking through the magnifying lens at a fabric, they could determine thread count and other ways of assessing the fineness of a fabric. So Leeuwenhoek had used a magnifying glass in his work as a cloth salesman. Why he began to make lenses for microscopes, we don't really know. But what he did start doing in the late 1650s is take rods of glass, melt them in a candle flame, and make droplet lenses. So the glass would melt because, somewhat surprisingly to me when I found this out, candles burn, even wax candles burn hot enough to melt certain kinds of glass. So he would melt a rod of glass in a candle flame until drops came down, they would cool, and then he could grind them and have very, very tiny lenses. And he would put them in a device like this. This is a single lens microscope. It doesn't look like a microscope because we all have in our mind the double lens in the tube kind that we probably all used in high school biology. But this single lens kind of microscope was very common in the Dutch Republic at the time. The other microscopists were all using them. And they looked like this. This is a reproduction of one. It's identical to what's on the screen, but I just brought it so that you could sort of see it in the metal. Leeuwenhoek would take two plates of brass or silver and put a little puncture, a little hole in the middle of each of them, put a glass bead in between the two of them, and then solder them together. And that bead would be the lens of his microscope. And the way he used it, I need to switch hands for this, the way he used it was the specimen would go on this pin in the back, and he would look at it through the bead lens by putting the microscope very close to his eye and turning this up towards a ray of sun coming through his study through a hole in the shutter. And he described it as turning it to the sky like you would with a telescope, which was interesting. Later, he would use it in a dark study with candlelight that he would sometimes magnify with a mirror, and he would look directly at the flame that way. So this was a Leeuwenhoek microscope. Once he started making these, he too started examining everything around him. He did examine different parts of a fly, including the eye. Up here, he doesn't draw it. This isn't a drawing of the eye per se here more. He was also extending the study of optical systems by spending a lot of time examining the optic nerve of a cow. He would cut very thin slices and look at that through the microscope. Eventually, he discovered red blood cells as well. He was the first person to see those. But later, in 1673, Leeuwenhoek found something that was truly remarkable. He had started writing to the Royal Society of London, and at that time, the Royal Society was the major scientific organization in the whole world. So if you were a natural philosopher, as the scientists were called then, you would write with your findings and your observations to the Royal Society. If they thought they had merit, the Society would read out your letter at a meeting, and then they would publish the findings in their journal. The journal was then sent all over Europe With the speed that you think of as Amazon Prime today, the journal, the Transactions of the Royal Society would be in London on one day, and within a week it would be in Rotterdam, and then by canal from Rotterdam to Delft, where Leeuwenhoek could see it. So the news traveled circulating around very quickly. Leeuwenhoek spent most of his career writing letters to the Royal Society. He wrote about 300 or 400 letters to the Royal Society. Many of them were published in part in their Transactions. They were written in Dutch and then translated into English. These were his only scientific publications. He never wrote a book. He never wrote a journal article. He just wanted to make observations, put down his findings, and just send it off and then get back to his microscope. This is his handwriting. This is his signature. You could see the letters in person at the Royal Society Library, where scholars can come in and look at the archives, and it's quite amazing. You can read them in facing Dutch and English pages in very big volumes that the New York Public Library has. I don't know if we have them here. But when I was in the New York Public Library in the summer of 2012, reading all 16 volumes, it was clear that they had never been checked out for decades. There was no electronic thing to check them out. They had to, you know, hand stamp them, and it took them like 3 weeks to find them in off-site storage. Here are some samples that he sent to the Royal Society with the letters. You can also see those at the Royal Society Library. This is labels that he wrote out in his hand. Here's a little wax paper. He folded up the specimens in. And this is a thin slice of an optic nerve of a cow. Now, in 1673, when he made an amazing discovery, he wrote right away to the Royal Society, and he wrote to them that he had seen in a small sample of lake water something truly remarkable. He said, some of them, these little particles that he saw, some of them were round, roundish. Those that were somewhat bigger than others were of an oval figure. On these latter, I saw two legs near the head, and two little fins on the outer edge of their body. Others were somewhat larger, and these were very slow in their motions. These little animals had diverse colors, some being whitish, others pellucid. Others had green and very shining little scales. Others, again, were green in the middle, and before and after, white. He had seen little animals in the water. They were moving themselves. They were living creatures. This was remarkable because no one had ever even imagined that there could be creatures that we didn't see. Even the little cheese mites on the howdahs, you know, they looked like dust. Then you could see that they were actually little mites, but you could see them with the naked eye. So too for the mold growing in the bread and the little flies. It was thought that lenses could magnify what was there, but not that they could make you see something that you couldn't otherwise see at all. So Leeuwenhoek's discovery was remarkable. It was perhaps the most remarkable discovery ever. And he talked about the motion of these animals being very fast, and he would spend hours looking at it. So he sent off this letter to the Royal Society. Now, this was a 26-page letter that... He started out talking about some observations of the cow optic nerve. Then he went on to talk about a trip he had taken to England many years before and how he had looked at the earth in the chalk hills and he compared the color and the size of the particles of the earth to the earth in the Dutch Republic, and how the Dutch earth was better for making glass and the English earth was better for making porcelain. And he went on and on and on about this. And then at the very end of the letter, it's that part that I quoted. So talk about burying the lead. And then the Royal Society ignored it. As far, you know, they didn't read the letter at their meeting. They didn't publish it in the Transactions. Leeuwenhoek's just going on with his observations. Finally, a year later, He sends them another letter, and he says, remember I had written to you about these little creatures? Well, I've been doing a lot more observations since then. And he sent them another letter telling them how he had melted snow water and looked at it, and then he added pepper, and he let the pepper sit there for a while, and there were all these creatures. And then he checked the water in the Delft canals, and there were many fewer creatures than he expected because the Delft canals are so clean. And he went on and on, and then finally, the Royal Society paid attention, but they asked him for proof. How did you make these observations? And he would not tell them. So finally, Robert Hooke, who had done that wonderful drawing of the drone fly and had published his own book about microscopic observations, although he had not seen anything not visible to the naked eye, Robert Hooke was asked to reproduce the observations of the invisible creatures, and he did see them, and then the Royal Society agreed that Leeuwenhoek had made a discovery. He then went on, he discovered sperm. These are sperm of dogs and rabbits. He made discoveries about circulation, about how the blood circulates through capillaries. William Harvey hadn't gotten to that point, so that was an important step. And by the end of his life, he was made a full member of the Royal Society of London, not a corresponding member the way other foreign scientists were, but a full member. And he was so proud of that, that in the one formal portrait of him that we're sure is him, Leeuwenhoek is depicted with the scroll and the ribbon that the Royal Society sent him, showing that he was a full member of the Royal Society. Now, at the same time that Leeuwenhoek is making these wonderful discoveries with lenses, across the market square, his neighbor, Vermeer, is also doing some remarkable things with lenses and mirrors, because here in the Procurus, remember I said this was probably a self-portrait of Vermeer. How did painters do self-portraits in this day? They used a mirror to see what they looked like, and they painted from it. Not only that, but here, these two hands, that is amazing. That is one of the most amazing examples of foreshortening in a painting, certainly of Vermeer, but also just of that period. Because it's very hard to paint a hand coming right out at you. And here, he's painting two of them with a coin about to drop into the outstretched hand of the courtesan. And so how could Vermeer have painted that so beautifully? And the answer is probably with the same mirror that he used to paint his self-portrait. And since the 1500s, even earlier, writers about art like the sculptor and architect Filarete were telling artists, use a mirror to depict foreshortening. So that's what I think Vermeer did. So he was using a mirror. Here, though, in this wonderful painting from the Frick, Vermeer is using something else. I would say a lens. Because with a double concave lens, a wide-angle lens, Vermeer, looking at this scene, would have found that the foreground figure was a lot larger than it should otherwise be. We know there were artists of the time using lenses like this. Garrett Dow was known to have a lens in a frame, and he would sit on one side and have his scene on the other side, and he would paint what he saw through it, and the lens would so magnify the scene that Dow had to wait until the dust settled to begin to paint. So it would not be unusual for Vermeer to use a lens like that. What's interesting, though, is that Vermeer emphasized how large the foreground figure is. Instead of compensating for it to make him approximately the same size as the other person in the picture, he made the man even larger than he would have looked with a lens. I think to emphasize how this very self-important figure here, the officer with his expensive beaver hat and his expensive lace cuffs, considers himself so much more important than the maidservant here, who he's getting drunk and he expects to be his eventual conquest. So we see here Vermeer using lenses, but not literally transcribing what he sees, but using them in a way to make his emotional point. Soon he starts using a camera obscura. Now, a camera obscura means dark room. They originally were just dark rooms. It was known since ancient times that if light passes through a small hole or aperture, the rays of the light will cross, and an image of what is outside the room will be projected onto the wall opposite the hole, but inverted because of the crossing of the rays. And so this is a depiction of a room being used as a camera obscura. The light is passing through here, the rays are crossing, and then an upside down figure of this little pagoda is being projected onto the wall. As early as the 13th century, astronomers were using these rooms like this, to observe the sun, to observe solar eclipses, to observe the movement of sunspots, because they knew if you stared at the sun, you would go blind, which you will, so don't do that. By the 16th century, it was recognized that if you put a lens in the hole, since remember by then there were lenses, if you put a lens in the hole, the image that's projected will be sharper. And at that point, it was starting to be recommended to painters that they use that setup in order to either learn how to paint the way Leonardo da Vinci recommended, or just to actually trace what's on the wall. Soon, that whole room configuration is shrunk down to the size of a box. Sometimes a mirror is added to the box so that the image will be projected on the top, on a piece of glass on the top of the box, and I have an example of that here. This is a box camera obscura. The lens is in a tube here, and something seen out here is projected into the box. I need to take this part off. At the top of the box is a piece of glass, and if you look inside in a dark room, you will see projected on top of here the image of the scene outside the lens. Now, if you remember the early kind of depictions of photographers with a cape or a hood over their head, they're using exactly this because photographic cameras were developed from camera obscuras. That's how they got the name. They would be using a box like this, and they would need something dark around them in order to see the image clearly on top of the glass. So by the time Vermeer started painting, there were artists who were using camera obscuras to paint. And I think Vermeer was looking through a box-type camera obscura like this in order to learn about how light helped us see, and how color appeared in different lights, and how perspective could be depicted. And I'll show you some images and tell you what I mean by that. In this wonderful painting also from the Frick, this one I kind of adopted when I moved back to New York to teach at St. John's, and I would go to the Frick a lot on their free days. Mistress and Maid was one of my favorites at the time. This is one of the wonderful paintings of Vermeer where the colors are so jewel-like and they jump out at you. That's a characteristic of images seen through a camera obscura because it concentrates color into a smaller area, and so the colors appear to be glowing and jewel-like, a hallmark of many of Vermeer's paintings. The camera obscura also probably helped Vermeer with the depiction of perspective. So in perspective, you have to take a three-dimensional scene and put it onto a two-dimensional surface, your canvas or your wood panel. In his early paintings, Vermeer had a lot of trouble with perspective. In this early Diana and her nymphs, this gold bowl is about to fall out of the frame of the painting. Here in A Maid Asleep from the Metropolitan Museum, he had so much trouble painting this bowl of fruit on the table. We know by X-ray analysis he repainted it many, many, many times, and then finally he just gave up and put all of this tapestry and everything over it, so we don't even know where the table is. So we can't say, oh, he didn't paint the bowl of fruit on the table, because who knows where the table is under all of that. However, just a year later, we get this painting, which is amazing, because everything in this painting the finial of the chair, the floor tiles, the head of the girl, the eye of the man, all recede to a single vanishing point in this painting. It's like perfect perspective. Now, Vermeer didn't need to use a camera obscura to get better at depicting perspective, and I'm not saying this alone is a knockdown piece of evidence, but when you look at an image on a camera obscura, what you're seeing is like you would see a photographic camera, you're seeing the scene outside depicted on a two-dimensional surface. So it's very helpful for showing an artist how to make its composition look like a two-dimensional depiction of a three-dimensional surface and how to do that properly. What Vermeer also would have learned by looking at images through the camera obscura is tonal value, that the color changes depending on the light you're seeing it in. Does anyone remember the blue or white dress thing on the internet? That's tonal value. Vermeer knew about that already in the 17th century. If you take a white shirt, or in this case, a white bit of fur, and you look at it in bright light, it's white. If you then look at it in a dark place, it's not white anymore. It's brown or gray. Our eyes tend to see it as white in both cases because we know it's the same piece of fur. So our mind sort of adjusts so that we see it as white. But in a camera obscura, you see it the way it actually is, which is white up here in the light and gray or brown down here in the shadow. And that's something Vermeer could not have learned by looking with his eyes. He had to learn it by looking through a lens. Also, in a camera, the contours are softened, especially with the lenses of those days, which were not perfect. And so in The Girl with the Pearl Earring, there's no line here at all. There's a bare modulation of tone in the flesh that makes us know there's a nose here, but he doesn't even draw a line. And that's the kind of an image you would see in a camera obscura. Another attribute of images seen through a lens or a camera obscura is that not all planes are focused at the same time, which even with our phone cameras now we know, right? Because you have to pick one spot to focus on, and then everything else in front of it and behind it will be a little out of focus. Vermeer starts painting that way. So in The Lace Maker, these lace pieces of thread in the foreground of the painting are just so impressionistically painted because they're not in focus. And of course, with our eye, we don't see that way. You know, I'm looking at you. You all are in focus to me right now. That's because the tiny muscles in the eye are constantly adjusting so that everything is in focus. So again, seeing that different planes are in and out of focus is an attribute, you know, something you would learn through looking through a camera obscura, not by looking at nature with the naked eye. And again, because the colors are so concentrated in a camera obscura, Vermeer could have learned by looking through one that shadows have colors. Shadows are never brown or black the way we think they are and the way, you know, children depict them. They have colors. And in this wonderful painting that I love so much, all the shadows are blue or barely green, because that's how they would appear through a camera obscura. In A View of Delft, this is the kind of painting that many painters who used a camera obscura would do, this sort of choreographical painting or a painting of a town. Vermeer probably did use a camera to paint this. There are the typical little white highlights that you see through looking at a lens, the little unresolved sparkles of white that you would see in a lens reflected from shiny surfaces in the sunlight. However, Vermeer does not just literally transcribe them. He puts them everywhere once he discovers these little highlights. They're not just in the water, they're on the wood of the boat, which would not be reflecting because it's not a shiny surface. In The Milkmaid, he puts those little highlights on the bread. Bread would not be shiny like that either. But somehow doing that makes this bread look so real to us that we feel we could just grab it. I basically want to say that Vermeer was using a camera obscura, but not to trace paintings. In that view of Delft, he paints the skyline of Delft as it was after they rebuilt, after the devastating explosion of the munitions dump in Delft. But he doesn't paint it exactly the way it was. He changes around the height of the roofs relative to each other to make it a better painting. So the way Vermeer used a camera obscura was to learn about how light worked and how it helps us to see. And that's what makes his paintings look to us like, you know, we've just stumbled onto someone reading a letter or cutting or pouring milk or weighing a piece of silver. Because he's showing us what sight is like. And the two of them working, probably not together, but maybe talking about their work over a beer in one of the many wonderful pubs in Delft, Vermeer and Leeuwenhoek on different sides of the market square, helped bring about a new way of seeing. They showed us that there's more than meets the eye. Right, we see little bacteria. This is in Leeuwenhoek's own hand, a little bacteria he saw in tooth plaque. And he said to the Royal Society, there's more little animals in an unclean mouth than there are in the whole kingdom of God. But you don't see them. There's more than meets the eye. And Vermeer saw, again, that there's more than meets the eye, that shadows can be blue or green, that highlights can appear on bread and somehow look real, and that a hand might not look like a hand. It might just look like a lump of flesh given the light. They both told us that the mind plays a role in seeing. Sometimes believing is seeing. These new optical instruments were very hard to use. Galileo has a wonderful passage where he talks about how hard it is to use his own telescope. He would take his telescope to people who did not believe there were mountains and craters on the moon. He would set up the telescope, have them look through it, and they still wouldn't see the mountains and craters on the moon. And one problem was that it was hard to use these instruments. Galileo said, you have to be careful because as you're holding the instrument, the circulation of blood through your fingers will cause a vibration and make it hard to see. And if you could somehow stabilize your hand so that the circulation of the blood was not moving the telescope, the vapor coming off your eyeball would fog up the lens, and you wouldn't be able to see. It was hard to see through these optical instruments, and that's why it was recognized for the first time that the mind can influence what you see. If it's hard to see, you need to somehow interpret what you're seeing. And the interpretation could sometimes go in a direction where you wanted it to go. If you didn't believe there could possibly be mountains and craters on the moon, you weren't going to see them. Leeuwenhoek, who discovered sperm and then suddenly thought sperm are the most important part of generation. At this time, nobody knew how new creatures were made. They had no idea about sperm and egg meeting and making an embryo. So the discovery of sperm was really important. And of course, since he discovered sperm, Leeuwenhoek thought sperm were the only important part of generation. So you didn't really need the eggs, which other people had seen. They were just like the nutrition of the sperm. So he thought there would be a little man in the sperm, a homunculus, the little creature just waiting to be fed by the egg and then turn into the little man. However, Leeuwenhoek did not draw this. Someone else did. And Leeuwenhoek ridiculed that person and said, you could not have seen this. I know because I have been looking for it and I have not seen it. And he said, no matter how much you want to see the little man, if you don't see it, it's not there. And you have to look again and again. And he talked about attentive observation. It's not enough to look. You have to look attentively and make sure that what you're seeing is really there. So he recognized that sometimes believing is seeing, but what he wanted was for seeing to be seeing. Now, at the same time, Vermeer took this idea that the mind plays a role in seeing and used it to his benefit. because when he painted this wonderful blue jacket in Woman in Blue Reading a Letter, he used very little of the expensive aquamarine paint that we think the jacket is full of. If you look at it through chemical analysis, it's mostly lead white and different kinds of black with a very minimal amount of the expensive blue paint. But Vermeer knew that we would see it as blue. And finally, both Leeuwenhoek and Vermeer were among the first people to help us realize that instruments could help us see deeper and farther. Not only could we use lenses to help poor vision be improved, to see dust as mites, but they could help us see what we otherwise didn't know was there, either stars and planets so far away that we couldn't see them with the naked eye, or little tiny creatures in our tooth plaque and in our blood, and well, not creatures, but little things, and in semen and other parts. We could see a whole world that we couldn't see with just the naked eye. And today, think of how far that's been taken by the followers of Leeuwenhoek and Vermeer. Now, with the Hubble telescope, we can see further than ever we could imagine, even in the past, by looking so far away. With PET scans and other technologies, we can see deep inside our own bodies, even the metabolic activity of cells. And I like to think of Leeuwenhoek and Vermeer looking down on us now and thinking, we did that. Thank you. Thank you. So I would love to take your questions. That's my favorite part of these events. Yes?
What led you to these two people other than a coincidence of birthdays?
That's a great question. My last book, The Philosophical Breakfast Club, that I spoke here about 4 years ago, almost exactly, was about a time in the 19th century where the professional modern scientist was invented. The word scientist was invented then, and then the scientist became a profession sort of unto himself. And at the end of that book, I reflected on how a kind of a byproduct of that was that the scientist became walled off from the rest of us, that people started to think that science was something that you had to be trained to do, nobody else could understand it. And as part of that, art and science went in two different ways, and in a way that's indicated by how the word scientist was invented by analogy explicitly with the word artist, and then they kind of split. And so what I wanted to do with this book was go back to a time where art and science was not seen as two different disciplines, where artists and scientists were recognizably involved in the same task. And in the 17th century in the Dutch Republic, that was the case. And then, of course, these two wonderful exemplars of that on either side, living in the same place and time, that was just irresistible. So I had to write this book. Yes, everything was less disciplinized. People knew so much. And it's not just because, you know, sometimes people say, well, there's more to know now, so no one can know everything. And it's also not just because they didn't have TV and Facebook and things and the internet. But there was a sense that to really understand one area, you needed to broaden out and to understand more. And part of the story I tell in my book, but I didn't have time to talk about it now, was how philosophers who were writing about scientific method, in particular Francis Bacon in England, influenced both the artists and the scientists of the time. So it wasn't just that the artists and scientists were working together, but the philosophers also were helping in that project. Yes?
I'm slightly confused about
Well, do you mean with perspective or with that things in different planes being?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, with I think I do. With in terms of the perspective, it's the main challenge for a representational artist is to be able to depict three-dimensional space on a two-dimensional surface. And so the way the camera could help with that is that the image of the three-dimensional space is being projected onto a two-dimensional surface. And so you could paint what you see, at least, I mean, not that that's easy to do. It's not that that makes it something we all could do, but it helps kind of understand how to do it in a given case. Also, I think, and, you know, there are many, many more, there's much more discussion of this in the book, of course, than I could do here, but I think looking at this kind of two-dimensional image on a camera obscura would also have helped Vermeer with composition. I mean, he was a master of composition, so I think why wouldn't he have used a device that could help him see, like, well, if I move this over here, you know, everything just falls into place so much nicer. So I think he would have availed himself of that technology. I hope that answers it. Anyone over here? I feel like I'm focusing on this side. Yes. Wow, that's a good question. Do you mean other previously invisible things that they might have wanted to depict, or?
Yeah, so I guess I see two possible answers there. Mm-hmm. Just said, it's not that something had been invisible, but the technique had not yet emerged for dealing with, say, the depiction of fire in a totally realistic, plausible way, and that technique itself had to advance to depict something that, yes, was still visible.
Right, well, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I can give you a great answer for that. I will say that in talking to artists working today, I've been more convinced than I even was when I had the idea for this book, that artists will use any technology that they can to help them see differently. Not that they feel they must do that, but certain artists will go to new technologies if they feel it can help them see the world in a new way. For instance, I spent time talking to a woman who actually used to work at Google and then decided she wanted to be a painter, and now she's painting using Google Glass. So she's seeing things in a very different way, and that technology is helping her to paint in a different way. And I know another artist who does a lot of work with 3D photography. And so that's a technology that would not have been available to someone in Vermeer's time, but this artist has it, and so he's going to, he feels that he needs to use that to do the kind of art that he wants to do. So I definitely would say that as new technologies arise, artists find ways to use them to depict the world or to see the world in a different way. Well, yes, and that's partly why Vermeer fell out of favor sometime after his death. You know, when he was living, he was pretty well known, and his paintings, few as they were sought out. After his death, in a couple of decades, people weren't as interested in his art, and many of his paintings that were unsigned were sold as paintings by another painter, by Pieter de Hoek. And some people think it was only with the advent of photography in the 19th century that his paintings were appreciated again, because it was something about getting used to looking through lenses again.
Let's not even think about the light at the moment, just the composition.
I don't think he traced.
Is he looking at it as looking
for it? No, I don't think so. That would be hard to do because you'd need to use the camera in a dark room. I think the way he used the camera obscura was as an experimental device, similar to how Leeuwenhoek was using a microscope. I think he was looking through a camera obscura as often as he could get one to help himself learn how color looked in different light, to help himself learn how you could depict perspective, how you would see these highlights on reflective surfaces, how contours would be softened, how shadows have colors, etc. I think he gained a kind of visual memory of what it looked like through a camera obscura, and then his paintings reflected that. But my belief is that Vermeer was not tracing from a camera image. Not only is it hard to imagine how you could do that today, it would have been really difficult to do with the lenses and mirrors of the time. Right. I mean, if I somehow found a document that's, Vermeer said, I'm using a camera obscura to trace, that would change my opinion. It wouldn't make him, in my mind, less of a painter. Because even that is a creative act. So I don't reject that thesis because I feel it would be a form of cheating. I reject it because it doesn't seem to capture the way artists in general were working in Delft at the time, the way lenses and mirrors worked at the time, because they weren't the modern-day perfect lenses and mirrors. And because of how Vermeer changed so many things, the highlights that wouldn't be there when you look through a camera, the way the red roofs were different in the Delft topography from how he painted it, and et cetera. It just doesn't seem to fit the evidence that he did paint that way. Yes, Hope. That's fascinating because people were amazed, but nobody was really that frightened by it. There were a few people who wrote about there were like armies of these creatures out to get us. And there was one microscopist who was steeping himself in tobacco smoke before he would leave the house because he felt that would protect him. But the funny thing is that Leeuwenhoek himself loved these little creatures. When the president of the Royal Society suggested that he look at the pus of smallpox victims to see if there were any little creatures in there, Leeuwenhoek said, oh no, there won't be any little creatures in there, because that would mean they were, somehow unhealthy. And he, when you, reading those 16 volumes of letters all in one summer was wonderful because over and over he talks about these creatures with so much affection. There's one summer where, like everybody else in Europe, in August he went away to the seaside. He brought some little tubes so he could take water and bring it back and look at it, but he spent 2 weeks away from his microscopes, and when he came back, he talked about how, he rushed back to his little teacups where the pepper infusions were waiting for him, and he said, and the creatures were all a prettily moving, even more than before. So you just feel that that he had this real affection for them. Yes.
It's said that Spinoza was
Yes.
And that he died from a pulmonary disease. Mm-hmm. What was lens grinding hazards?
Well, because all the little glass particles, they didn't wear a mask, they didn't know. Spinoza is fascinating, and he makes an appearance in my book because he was born just a few weeks after Leeuwenhoek and Vermeer, so he's an exact contemporary. And when he left Amsterdam originally, when he was sort of thrown out of his family business and started grinding lenses, there was one summer where he was living a few kilometers from Delft. And another interesting, sort of intriguing fact is that around that time, Leeuwenhoek starts using a kind of a lathe, like that jewelers would use to grind jewelry, but it had a very odd setup, which it would have to in order to work for glass grinding, but it's identical to what Spinoza was using to grind lenses at that time, 2 kilometers away. So I like to think that they may have known each other, and they both knew someone in common who lived right between them. So it's not impossible that they knew each other and that Spinoza influenced Leeuwenhoek. Yes?
I think you could bring up Van Eyck in your discussion, mm-hmm. because he not only used the curved mirror, mm-hmm. which showed things that you couldn't see in his picture. So in a way, it's a forerunner.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Velazquez. I mean, other people were using mirrors.
Yes, but he's mm-hmm. right in the tradition. Mm-hmm. This guy would have known his painting.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there's a wonderful Van Eyck of Canon van der Pella, and he's holding a pair of glasses,
mm-hmm.
and those glasses are magnifying something mm-hmm. that you see behind it.
Right.
That would be very nice for your introductory.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, there is that whole, like, earlier Northern European, Northern Netherlandish tradition that these painters obviously knew about.
Yeah.
But also Velazquez, because remember, the Spanish were in the Dutch
of his century.
Yes, yes, but he would have known him. He may have known his work as well. Because of the Spanish-Dutch connection then. That's fascinating. Thank you. Yes. Oh, sorry.
I was interested in the visuality of the mm-hmm. world in a way that's far beyond what these guys were doing. And we don't know that, it's never been brought up that he used any aids, but his detail is another step,
mm-hmm.
even beyond what Vermeer was doing in his earlier stuff.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. I think first I had called on someone back there.
You talked about studying his letters.
I'm sorry, studying?
You spoke about studying many volumes.
Oh, yes, of Leeuwenhoek's letters. Mm-hmm.
How multilingual was he? Like, how many different languages did he write?
He only wrote in Dutch. So as I said, they were Dutch-English translations. I was reading them in English, looking at the Dutch, but, relying on the English. Because they were translated when he wrote them and sent them to the Royal Society. The Royal Society translated them into English in order to be able to read them out to the members and then publish them in the transactions. But what's particularly interesting about that is that Leeuwenhoek always talked about how he only knew Dutch. He didn't know any other languages. He denied up and down all the time that he knew any English. But when he was apprenticed to a cloth salesman, before he himself was able to become one in Amsterdam, he was apprenticed to a Scottish drapier who had come to the Netherlands. And at a certain point at the end of his apprenticeship, Leeuwenhoek had essentially power of attorney for him. So I feel he must have been able to at least read letters coming to him in English. at some points he makes comments about how when he's studying the eye of a beetle, he says, so it shows the absurdity of the English expression, blind as a beetle. So that's, you know, it's like, well, how does he know that's an English expression? So there are little hints there that he knew more English than he was letting on. Well, the Royal Society would have a translator because since it was the only major scientific organization at the time, scientists from all over the world were writing in and corresponding with the secretary of the Royal Society. So they would have to have all those letters translated into English.
Sorry.
That's okay.
No,
that's a good question. They would write in English and then have their translator translate it into Dutch and send it back. But, you know, the other interesting thing is he would still get the issues of the transactions of the Royal Society. He would have them sent to his sister in Rotterdam, who would then have them sent back to him in Delft. And he would have people, friends, the Anglican clergymen, and other people translate from the English into Dutch for him. It's a wonderful sort of fact about science at this time that it was very multilingual, and there were all these different languages. It wasn't like there was just one language of science like there is now, and the story of how it got to be that way is an interesting one.
Did they study, was there enough work out there for them to study?
Well, I'll take the easier question first, which is also a hard question, the numbers. We know of about 35 Vermeer paintings, depending on how you count. There are some contested ones. It is thought by the conservators at the Met, Metropolitan Museum, that he painted 45, probably. We know of at least two that were listed in catalogs under his name that were subjects that were similar to what he was otherwise painting at the time that are lost now. And other than that, we don't know. So, but he painted very slowly. He used this very optical process where not only was he making observations with a camera, but he layered his paint so beautifully in order to get that sort of depth that you get with vision, and to get his other optical aspects in the painting. So he was a very slow painter. In terms of his influence, as I mentioned, in the 19th century, he was kind of rediscovered. Once photography was invented, some influential people were talking about Vermeer as having taken the first daguerreotypes. Which of course he didn't. He painted them, but he was associated with photography. So people started studying him then. I do not know how much he influenced particular painters in the 19th and 20th century, though. Sorry. Yes?
Do you know what your next topic is? Will you tell us?
Yes, and only vaguely. I do know my next topic. It's going to be something different from this in that it won't directly have to do with art, but it will be similar to my other books in having to do with the way science is embedded in culture in general and affects other things. This one will have to do with sort of science, religion, and politics. Yes? Yes.
When you were working on it, can you describe a little bit about how the process of you getting new ideas to pursue, you're just listing them all, and then, or is it that one hits you and you said, aha, that has to be the next book?
I've been very lucky that I get hit with these ahas, but it usually happens after a lot of thinking and just sort of poking around, reading things. Both in the last, with all of my books, the idea has kind of arisen while I was finishing up the book before, which is nice that happens. I see Lauren nodding because she's also a writer and she knows it's really nice when that happens. but then when I have an idea, I always run it by my agent to see whether he thinks it's a good one because he has a very good nose for that and he loved this idea, so I have high hopes. Now I have to write it though. Any other questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who really had it in right. for Newton?
Yes.
And what's his name?
Bacon.
Bacon.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
He said, art is the tree of life, science is the tree of death.
Right. he was very adamant about things.
Using it with a new Newton,
mm-hmm.
with a contractor like
right.
that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, it's wonderful. Right, and unfortunately, it persists today. And that's really why I'm writing books like this, because I think there are too many people who think that science has nothing to do with their lives or interests, and it's something, you know, in an ivory tower. But I think that's a very dangerous belief. And so the way that I try to address that issue is to write these historical books that show it wasn't always that way. It's not that way now. I teach philosophy and history.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you.